Hello, my name is John Smetanka, and the name of our program is With Respect. Today's guest on With Respect is John Milton Cooper, Jr., who is a historian, a professor at the University of Wisconsin, and a scholar who has written a number of books about the period from 1900 to 1925. We'll be talking especially about his biography of Woodrow Wilson. With Respect, John Milton Cooper, Jr. We'll be right back. John, how are you today?
Just fine, John. How are you?
I'm great. All right. John, I gave you a lead-in to say that you're writing about the period, you're studying and writing about the period of 1920 to 1925. Now, that's a long time ago. Even I don't go that far back.
You don't? Well, I don't either, as a matter of fact.
All right. But how is that period of time that important that you want to spend part of your life, maybe all of your life, writing, studying and writing about it?
Well, I hope it hasn't been all of my life just yet, but yes, I have spent a lot of it. I think this period, John, was so many extremely important and fascinating things came together. At home, domestically, it's been called a second golden age of American politics following the generation of the founders of the Republic. It had just amazing people who were men and women, black and white, who were leaders, thinkers, who really participated in public life. The other thing is, this is really the beginning of the United States' role in the world as a great power. There had been a little bit back at the time of the Spanish-American War, but that had been just a slight foretaste that had been put aside and not quite forgotten, but largely put out of mind. And this is when we really were in the midst of it. And it's also, by the way, World War I is our first big overseas war. So those are the things that that really shape an awful lot. I mean, I'd say the rest of the 20th century, and in many ways right down to where we are now, comes out of the consequences of that period.
Well, we're going to follow up on that, but first I want to ask you this. All right, John, this is, everybody gets this question.
Okay.
Where are you from originally?
Well, the short answer is I was born in Washington, D.C. Now, in those days, and today still, you're from Washington. Everybody says, yeah, but where are you from? Well, my family was from North Carolina, and in fact, they moved back to North Carolina when I was just a small a baby, really, and then eventually moved back and stayed in Washington. So that's, you know, I'm still consider myself something of an expatriate Southerner.
Well,
as was Woodrow Wilson.
Now, you started off life basically in North Carolina was one of the places that you had some focus to your early days. Where did you go to school? Tell me about your family, your mom, dad.
Okay. Well, my father was a congressional staffer. In fact, he was the clerk of the House Ways and Means Committee when I was born. And the reason he was because his congressman was the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee. And then he went back and was the counsel for a textile company down there for a while. He also served in the Navy during World War II and then decided to hang out his shingle as a Washington lawyer. And to be honest, he was mainly a lobbyist. The consequence of that for me was that my summer jobs in high school were on Capitol Hill. In other words, he could, you know, these were not elevated. I was folding documents and delivering things to congressional offices. You know, I got summer jobs. And then, I went to Woodrow Wilson High School in Washington, D.C., and then I went on to Princeton and for an undergrad, and then went to Columbia for graduate work. I taught for 5 years at Wellesley College, which I think most people know where that is because one of our presidential candidates is a graduate of Wellesley, and in fact, I did know her, never taught her in class, but I did know her back then. And then in 1970, I moved to Madison and taught for 43 years at the University of Wisconsin. So, you know, I'd moved around. Now, what happened was, I've got to tell you this story, and you'll appreciate this. As you can see, my early life was moving north, moving up the East Coast, and the main consequence of that, as far as I was concerned, was I was getting a bit more taste of winter each time. Well, by the time we lived in Massachusetts for a while and had a couple of really snowy winters, I thought, okay, now I know what winter is. Well, then we moved to Wisconsin, and I discovered, no, I did not. But no, that's been the course of my life. Now, if I could, you know, given those circumstances, look, I went to a high school named after this man. I went to the college where he went and was president of that college, and then the fellowship I had when I started out grad school was a Woodrow Wilson fellowship, and people say, oh, well, you know, that's just the twig was bent. It really didn't happen that way for me, John. I was interested in politics and New Deal reform and the debate over going into World War II, and I started out to work on that in grad school, and what I found was that you know, from the outbreak of World War II in Europe down to Pearl Harbor, that era of a great debate, I discovered I was reading about the second act, that the first act was back in World War I. And, you know, historians like to go back as far as they can for origins of things, and I did. And, frankly, I got hooked. I simply got hooked. It was the fascination of that period.
It is a fascinating period. Now, I went through a period recently, and my audience has gone through it with me because I've interviewed a number of folks who have written scholarly and popular works about the run-up from the 1930s on to through the Second World War. Mm-hmm. So I became fascinated with the parallels that I see and saw different times in our country and even today. In the debates over whether we would get into the war in Europe or not. But I then, even before I read your book, I was acutely aware that we had the same kinds of debates which occurred prior to going into the First World War.
And, yes, we did. We sure did.
And we're going to talk about that in a minute, but I want to finish out one other thing. How about your mom and dad? You said your dad was worked on the Hill as a staffer. My brother worked for 40 years in the House Judiciary Committee.
Is that right?
Is there a counsel?
Uh-huh.
So I know staffers and I know the staffer life. But how about your mom?
My mother was a homemaker. She was a homemaker, and we were a very traditional 1950s family, and it was fine. I went the high school route and all of it. Although the Woodrow Wilson High School was a very interesting place to go, John. It's that enclave, the far northwest Washington, north of Georgetown, north of the cathedral, up there, and it was basically all white there. I started high school right after the Brown decision, and when I finished high school 3 years later, it was only 3 years. I didn't go through faster. I think we had 2 or 3 black students out of 1,500 in the high school. But something they did was they immediately moved several black teachers, senior and very, very good black teachers, over from what had been the colored schools. And one of them was a chemistry teacher. I didn't take chemistry, and so I didn't have him. But I did have Mrs. Jackson for social studies, and it was marvelous. I mean, it was the first time I had ever known a really educated black person. And I think that was true for most of us. You know, people would say, oh, well, that was just a tokenism there. Well, sure, it was tokenism, but I think it was very useful tokenism for us, you know, us white kids there. And the other thing, it was an interesting religious ethnic mix, too, of this practically lily white school, because Washington, like many places, I think Detroit would be an example, Chicago had a very extensive parochial school system, which meant that that's where the Catholics went, by and large. And a parochial school system, which started with just plain old local parish schools and went all the way up through some very, very tony prep schools. So there weren't very many Catholics there, but of the rest of us, we were divided probably maybe 60-40 Protestants and Jews. And unlike a lot of places, you know, like in some of the Chicago suburbs or Boston suburbs, you know, where the Jewish kids will be the brains and the others, the Gentiles, will be the jocks or the meatballs or whatever. That wasn't the case there. I mean, it was really just a very, very smart bunch of kids. And in some ways, the fastest intellectual company I've ever been in my life was in high school, despite the fact that I went on to and taught at some very, very good schools. So it was a very interesting upbringing, and I've always been happy about it.
How about brothers and sisters?
I had a sister. She died. She died 15 years ago. She was 6 years younger than I was. She went to the same schools, had a similar experience. She went on to Duke, and then right out of Duke, she went into the Peace Corps. She wanted to go to. She got fascinated with Africa, so she went into the Peace Corps, and she had a good bit of French. So they sent her to one of the Francophone countries, former French colonies, Chad, which is kind of, if you look at, you know, the bite of Africa, it's right up in there, inland. It's an inland country. She wanted to get back to the old, real Africa, not the westernized coasts there, and she did. She met and married a guy, not an African, interestingly, but a Frenchman, because the French had sort of their equivalent of a Peace Corps before we did. What they did was that since they had universal military service for males, they allowed them, after they'd spent, I think they had to spend 6 months in uniform, to do different kinds of work in these former French colonies. And my brother-in-law was a math teacher already, so he went there and finished that out and then just kept on. He could accumulate his seniority and everything within the French system by doing that. So they lived in Africa for 8 years and had a wonderful time. And their adjustment was coming back to France, coming back to a Western cost of living, having to make do like that, because no, they weren't getting paid much in Africa, but the franc, the dollar went a long, long way.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Well, all right. John, I think it's time for a revelation that we have a contact we didn't know in common until we began talking about you doing the show, and that is my cousin. My cousin, Phil,
right.
was a dean at the University of Wisconsin and mm-hmm. became your friend.
Now, yes, indeed.
And that is a sad thing for you because I was able to tell you that my cousin, who was about a few years older than me, came by the house where I was spending time at age 5 or 6. I had just gotten a Lionel train set, and that train set included a caboose. And guess what happened? That went away.
Yes.
That went away.
Mm.
Where did it go? Phil took it. And so that person, who I thought was a friend and a cousin, stole my caboose, and he turns out to be your friend, which I am sad for you. He told me later, years later, he told me that I told him I wanted it back, and he said he gave it to gypsies, and he would never give it back to me. So, as far as I'm concerned, you're friends of a felon. All right.
Well, I'll have to discuss that with Phil, and I think maybe we could I'll make him go on eBay, maybe with his son's poker winnings, to get you a replacement caboose, because that's Rosebud. I mean, that's Rosebud.
It truly is. We're going to take a break now. We're talking to John Milton Cooper Jr., who is the author of a biography entitled Woodrow Wilson. We're going to be talking about Woodrow Wilson for the rest of the show, but when we get back, I want to see that the segue into the reign or the time of presidency of Woodrow Wilson and how that all happened. This is John Smetanker, one with respect, and we'll be right back. We're now back on With Respect with John Milton Cooper, who is the author of a biography of Woodrow Wilson. This is John Smetanka. John, when we broke, after talking about my ne'er-do-well cousin,
yes.
I said we're going to start talking about Woodrow Wilson. Now, the basics, I think, are simple. He became president of the United States in the 1912 election and left.
That's right.
left the White House after two terms in 1920 and died in 1924. Now, that doesn't tell the story about either the United States or, really, Woodrow Wilson and his place as a human as well as a president. And I think in your book, I want to congratulate you because it is a long book, but it is written, it flows very well. And I see written in bold letters, I see the good things about Woodrow Wilson and the not so good things, which I always think is a lot better than somebody writing a pane of praise to a fallen individual. The reality is always better than
I think so too.
Tell me about him. Tell me about Woodrow Wilson.
Well. Actually, New York Times crossword clue this morning on a Sunday was Woodrow Wilson was the only prez to have one, three letters, and the answer was PhD. He's our only PhD president, and also the only one who was a professional academic. In other words, he was a professor and a college president before he went into public life. So that's unique thus mm-hmm. far. We've never had another one. One of the things when he first got into public life, he went literally within the space of a little more than 2 years from being an academic, the president of Princeton, to being president of the United States.
Well, let's stop right there. That is fascinating because now this fellow came from a religious background, didn't he?
Yes, you know, he certainly did. I mean, he was born in a Presbyterian manse. Which, by the way, it's in Staunton, Virginia. That's that town that looks as if it ought to be pronounced Staunton, but it's Staunton. Mm-hmm. A very lovely little town down in the Shenandoah Valley, not far from Charlottesville. And I'll be a booster for Staunton. It's just a lovely place, and anybody who's on a trip down there really ought to just stop by. His birthplace is there. It's the Presbyterian manse, and it's preserved, and he was only 18 months old when the family moved away, but it's a lovely example of what a very, you know, fairly distinguished Presbyterian minister would have, how they would have lived, and the kind of house they had. Wilson was the son, obviously, the grandson, the nephew, and later became the son-in-law of Presbyterian ministers. And he looked and sounded in many ways like a preacher. In fact, the looks I think are one of the less fortunate things about him. He's not a handsome man, but a perfectly decent looking man. But he had a long jaw and a rather beaky nose. And you know, the way they did photographs in those days, people had to sit rigidly still for the most part, so that. You get to get an idea that this was a very stern person, which he really wasn't. He was, not a laugh a minute guy, but very, very. He liked to joke. He liked limericks. He could play pranks and things like that. He was a good baseball player, sports fan, liked music, liked body, you know, all the things that regular people like. And but people immediately, I think, it's been so easy to stereotype him. As some kind of religious zealot or, you know, head in the clouds utopian or a guy with a messiah complex. Well, no, he was none of those things. He was brought up in one of the most liberal, sophisticated religious environments available, certainly in the United States, in the mid-19th century, and maybe in some places in the world. And the Presbyterians were the real intellectuals of Protestantism, and much less emotional and evangelical than, say, the Baptists or the Methodists. And this was the kind of atmosphere, and his father for a while was on the faculty of the theological seminary, so that he grew up in an atmosphere that was, I think, as much academic as it was clerical. So that it plays a different role, and he's not. For one thing, I think it was his religious grounding that really insulated him against having any kind of messiah complex. I mean, if you're a good Christian and you know it inside out, the one thing you know you cannot be is a messiah. You know, that's reserved to God, and that's reserved to Christ. And Wilson never thought that. And I once said, and this was a kind of a mean remark to make, it was 10 years ago when George W. Bush was president, but I said, when Wilson took us into World War I in 1917, he did not think God was telling him to do it. And then I stopped and I said, I'm just talking to an audience in Washington, in fact, mm-hmm. and I said, I really don't mean that. You might think that's an implied criticism of the way a certain Republican president took us into war. And I said, no, it's not. It's not a criticism of the way President McKinley took us into war in 1898. But Wilson just... What you have to do, I think there are certain times in his life when that religious grounding does become extremely important. But by and large, this was the background to his life, and he very much a creature of this world. He did not like at all mixing religion and politics, even in a liberal direction, because those days, by the way, another thing that's interesting about that era is you had this movement mainly among Protestant churches, but not exclusively. There's an interesting Catholic and Jewish involvements too, called the social gospel, and this was where they were really getting involved in social reform and social service and doing a lot of interesting things and helping out and affecting politics. Well, Wilson didn't even care for that. He didn't like the moral reform stuff then, which prohibition is the outstanding example of that kind of cultural social issue. He never had any truck with that. But he really was very chary of getting the liberal religious people either. He just wanted to keep a good separation. I think one of the ironies is his great rival, and another thing I've written about is exactly that, the great rivalry between him and Theodore Roosevelt. And it was Theodore Roosevelt who called the White House a bully pulpit and compared presidential leadership to preaching. And Theodore Roosevelt was probably, I think almost certainly, a religious skeptic. It was not this minister's son. In fact, he was a great speaker, and he liked to do speeches and talk to the public, but he didn't compare it to preaching. He saw these as very, very different things. So, you know, in some ways, John, I think you could say he is one of our two most conspicuously religious presidents. The other one I'd say was Jimmy Carter. But in both cases, I'd say this for Carter as well, a Baptist and more evangelical, very sophisticated men, not people who think that the voice of God is speaking in their ears, or who want everybody to follow because they've got the complete word of God. Neither of them nor Carter isn't that way.
There's a quote that you attribute to Wilson talking about, made in private, talking about how presidents do or do not bring people, or God brings people to war. What was that quote?
This was right after the sinking of the Lusitania. You know, last year was the 100th anniversary of the sinking of the Lusitania. By the way, that is the, I think, the great turning point. First great turning point for the United States in World War I. That's when it really came home to us. World War I had broken out in Europe in August 1914, and it was very, very widely covered in the American papers. So we knew what was happening over there, believe me. But there's a sense for those first few months, well, this is a terrible thing, and we sympathize with them, and we organize relief efforts, and we had national prayer days. But this is happening to other people. This is happening to somebody else. We're 3,000 miles away. You know, that's Europe. You know, that's what we white European descended people. That's what we came here to get away from. You know, so there's that sense. The Lusitania brings it home to us because 126 Americans were killed out of, I think it's about 1,200 people were killed, and about 10% of those were Americans. And it really, that was, that John, I think, is about the closest parallel we've had to 9/11, more so than Pearl Harbor. But anyway, this is right after the sinking of the Lusitania, and there's all, obviously, a great deal of talk and public agitation. And somebody had written in to the president, "In the name of God, declare war." And Wilson said, "War is not declared in the name of God. It is a human affair altogether." So, no, that's how he approached it, very much so.
Well, now, you've mentioned several things about him being an academic.
And, right.
But he was also a person, you trace out, that found out that the world of academic politics was, in many respects, more brutal than running for president and being president.
Well, yeah, this was, John, when he first got into politics, the reporters would ask him, and they would couch it as politely as they could, but it was basically, "Hey, Doc, how is it an ivory tower academic like you does so well in the real world, real politics?" And he had an answer for it. He said, "Listen," he said, "after academic politics, the real thing is so much nicer and so much more above board." And I don't know whether Phil's ever talked to you very much about academic politics, but all I can say to what Wilson said there is amen, because academic politics can be extremely nasty.
I teach in Europe every year with a group of law professors, and while we are over there, I listen to them. We're all very social, lovely, talk to each other about all kinds of interesting things. And then when I'm around, but they begin to talk about internal stuff, mm-hmm. The whole tenor of the conversation changes. Their voices change. the level gets very acrid, mm-hmm. and somewhat picky. Mm-hmm. And I want to say, time out. This is just a law school. Come on, this is not the. But this is their world, and it's tough.
I had my epiphany, my light bulb moment about that when I was just finishing up being chair of the department at the UW, in a very nastily contested election for my successor. And my wife, who's a lawyer and was with the legal department of the insurance company, I would obviously unload to her afterward about how this was. And I once asked her, I said, "Well, is it like this in business?" And she said, "No, except at the very top." But then she said, "I'll tell you where it is like this, in the law firms."
Well,
to me, that was my aha moment, because I thought, yeah, lawyers, doctors, academics, we're lone operators. Our concept of what really matters is what we do by ourselves. In fact, we academics have a phrase, "Well, what are you doing?" "Well, I'm doing some of my own work," meaning I'm doing my research and my writing, as opposed to teaching or administering or whatever else we're getting paid to do. And it's that sense of being a lone operator. Now, look, business people, soldiers, bureaucrats, they've all got their problems, but they're socialized into working together. I mean, that's real work to them. And when you have people who think, what's really important is what I do by myself. And I had never, the term herding cats had not come into use yet when I was chair. But boy, when I first heard it, it had a visceral meaning for me.
Well, we're going to take a break. But before we do, I was going to tell you that I worked in the Department of Justice, and we had 10,000 lawyers at least at that point. And what I described it to people back home was that I was involved in managing 10,000 cats with big egos. And that's really what it was like. All right, we're going to take a break right now. We're talking to John Milton Cooper, who is a professor at the University of Wisconsin, who has written the book biography, an excellent biography, of Woodrow Wilson. This is John Smetanka, and we're on With Respect, and we'll be right back. We're now back on With Respect with John Milton Cooper, who is the author of a book called Woodrow Wilson, a biography, and has written not only about Woodrow Wilson, but about the whole era from 1900 to 1925. And we've sketched little bits and pieces of it. But I want, John, I'd like you to back up. And Woodrow Wilson came up with some brilliant revolutionary ideas on how to run a university. And were they all accepted at his own home?
No, they weren't, John. It's interesting. He hit the ground running. He was chosen, to his surprise, you know, this was not something that he'd been angling for, chosen president of Princeton in 1902. In fact, he was just about to get started on what he considered his magnum opus as a political scientist, writer, and had to put that aside, and never did do it. What he wanted to do, Princeton was, had a lot of social prestige, was not extreme admired all that much academically, not regarded as being a really high-powered place. It was a, good old college, kind of like Amherst and Dartmouth and places like that. And Wilson, not single-handedly by any means, I mean, he had plenty of support and help, but wanted to transform this into a front-rank university. In fact, he's very honest about this. He wanted to knock Harvard off the pedestal. In other words, he wanted Princeton to be up there, regarded as the top university. And what this meant was upgrading the faculty, making the students work harder, and making it a serious, intellectually and academically serious place in a way that it really hadn't been, or had been only to a much lesser degree. So what he did was, first of all, he reorganized the faculty, the first time that they were organized into departments. And interestingly, his own department, which he named, is to this day still called politics, not political science. He didn't like the term political science. He didn't really consider it a science, although he was later president of the American Political Science Association. Anyway, so he organized it into departments. He got rid of some faculty dead wood, and sometimes could be a little tough about doing that. And then what he wanted to do, the eternal problem for being a front-rank academic institution, is how to combine the advantage of the university, which is the, cutting-edge research in scholarly fields and in sciences, with the advantage of the small college, which is intimate instruction. And how do you do that? Well, it's difficult. It's, in some cases, it's impossible. But that's, that's what the really top ones try to do. So, first of all, he recruited a whole bunch of faculty stars. I mean, he got eminent scientists and up and coming academic stars, but he also then brought in 54-55 junior instructors that he called preceptors. They were supposed to be almost a separate kind of faculty who was going to be much closer to the students, and the idea was that if he could find a way to have them live together with the students. And there was a certain some of this on Oxford and Cambridge, the colleges, and trying to put those together. Well, he brought in the preceptors. I mean, he just, believe me, having spent a lot of time in academia, they call the pace glacial for the way changes get made. Well, Wilson just did a whole bunch of things within 2 or 3 years. Well, then he ran into trouble. He ran into trouble because he thought the best thing of all would be if the preceptors and even some of the senior faculty could live among the students, that they could, they kind of rub off on each other, but especially that the seriousness of the scholars would rub off on the students. So he wanted to introduce what he called colleges or quads, the quad plan, which was actually later taken up first by Harvard and then by Yale, with the college, the houses and the colleges. He tried to introduce that, and this ran afoul of the clubs. Princeton doesn't have Greek letter fraternities, but it has the same thing with these what they call eating clubs, and this was seen as a threat to the clubs and to their social exclusiveness, and Wilson lost on that one, or at least kind of fought to a face-saving draw to try to do that. Well, the other thing he wanted to do, though, was to locate the residence, the dorms, really, for the graduate students right in the middle of the campus, because he thought having the grad students mixed in with the undergrads would, again, raise the intellectual level. And this got him into a fight with the dean of the grad school, which he eventually lost, because the dean of the grad school was able to come up with some money specifically earmarked to have a separate facility kind of off campus, and it really tore the place apart, and the trustees, the most powerful trustees, turned against him, and he
found out that politics was pretty rough.
This academic politics was it was. I mean, he wasn't kidding. He wasn't just, you know, just giving a stock answer when he said that. I mean, this was mean and figuratively cutthroat. Absolutely.
But now here's a fellow who goes from this academic whirlwind maelstrom, and he becomes governor and then president of the United States, all in a period of what, 2 years?
Yep. Well, what happened was he was a political scientist and somebody who spoke out a lot on political matters, not so much some current issues, but more approaches to politics and things like that. And he attracted the attention of some conservative Democrats who wanted to rescue the party from what they saw as the heresy of William Jennings Bryan and his populist-tinged people. And they saw this guy as a kind of white hope for that, and they started getting him around and getting him exposed. So he'd gotten some political exposure. Well, what happened though was, while these were his original patrons, were these conservatives, he had really pretty much begun to re-examine where he stood politically, and the conclusion he came to very quickly was that he didn't belong with the conservatives, that he was a progressive, that he liked much more the ideas of, say, somebody like Wisconsin's Bob La Follette or Theodore Roosevelt, who was president then, who was beginning to move in that direction. But anyway, you got to say this about him: he was quite opportunistic. He didn't tell off his conservative patrons and say, "Oh well, hey, by the way, gentlemen, I don't agree with you anymore. So go find somebody else." He just kept quiet about it. And what they did was they were able to conspire. And conspire is a good word with the bosses, the Democratic bosses of New Jersey, to get him the nomination for governor. So just as things were falling apart around his head at Princeton, along comes this lifeline to go into politics, which, by the way, that's what he wanted to do originally before he went into academic life. He really wanted to be a politician.
Well, he not only was looked at as governor material in New Jersey, but he was, from the very beginning of his political new career, they were talking about him for president. In fact, they nominated him, and he was elected in 1912, but that was a special election, wasn't it?
One for the books. What happened was Theodore Roosevelt, who could never be happy not being president, found a convenient enough excuses or reasons. I don't want to make him sound terrible here, but to oppose his handpicked successor, William Howard Taft, to run against him for the Republican nomination. And when he didn't get it, Roosevelt formed his own new party, the Progressive Party. Now, Roosevelt had really moved and you could use the term of come out of the closet much more as a progressive reformer than he'd been as president, although that was happening when he was president. So he split the Republicans. Now, the Republicans, after 1896, down to the early 1930s, had the strongest lock on controlling the White House and Congress that any party has had, really. I mean, they were the dominant party. And what happened, though, was that they were split, and Wilson basically came in. Now, he deserves some credit for running his own campaign and really setting forth his vision. But basically, all he had to do was just be the candidate of an undivided party, and he was elected president with 43% of the vote.
And that's of course not a majority, and we've had Several presidents.
He had an electoral college majority, though,
right.
A big one.
Right, but this is not the first time, nor was it the last, that a person with a smaller than 50% vote and the popular vote became president because of the electoral college.
That's right. That's right. Now, well, look, first of all, Abraham Lincoln was a minority president. Harry Truman, John Kennedy, the only except for Franklin Roosevelt, Jimmy Carter in 76, and Barack Obama twice now, the Democratic presidents of the last 100 years have not had majorities.
Yes.
And Richard Nixon didn't have a majority in 68. So we've had a lot of minority, plurality presidents, I think would be the better way to put it.
All right. Now, John Cooper, Woodrow Wilson walked into a White House in 1912, and he walked out in 1920. Was the White House, that was the political world, and was the world, the same as in 1912 as it was when he walked out in 1920?
No, absolutely not. I mean, all you have to do is say three words, World War One. That alone. And when Wilson became president, all the major powers in Europe and Asia, except France, were monarchies. When he left office, except for Great Britain, Great Britain and Japan, none of them were monarchies. These dynasts, these monarchs, these emperors empires had been overthrown. And in Russia, of course, there was a new revolutionary government there, the Bolsheviks, the communists, Europe was war torn and really torn apart very, very, very badly. I mean, I don't know how you would compare the level of death and destruction between the two world wars. I mean, in absolute numbers, they're larger in World War II, but just the kind of ripping apart of Europe that happened in World War I was really terrible. So no, it was a changed world, an absolutely a world that was overturned. And really, they talk about the short 20th century internationally, which would be 1914 to 1989. In a sense, the whole coming apart that happened in World War I, at least for the Western world, really didn't get resolved until the fall of the Iron Curtain. I mean, those things, one thing really literally leads to another. But of course, if you look beyond Europe, I mean, the consequences of what came apart in World War One are still with us. I mean, that's the Middle East. I mean, Syria, Iraq. I mean, these are artificial creations. These are creations of the Western powers.
Yes. In fact, I had a fight one night in London. I was at a party and I was tired, and I just come into London from the Czech Republic, and they were beating up George Bush, and I was at a dinner party in Wimbledon, and 15 people, and they were about 11:30 at night. They said, "All right, John, what do you think about George Bush?" And I said to my friend who invited me, I said, "No, it's too late. Don't do this." So they started beating the bejesus. "Oh, we need to hear your view." Finally, we got to the point I couldn't take it anymore. And one of these ladies, very brilliant, all these are all brilliant people, said,
"But so articulate too."
That's right. And they said, "But you people don't, in America don't understand. This is not that these countries, Iraq, Iran, Syria, these were tribes. You don't understand this." And I looked at them. And I said, "Excuse me, who's responsible for that?"
Yes.
And one woman turned to the other and says, "Ooh, I think that was us." And I said, "That's right. Balfour, Churchill, and Gertrude.
Gertrude Bell."
Now, okay, he walks in to this world which is just teetering on the edge. We talk about the guns of August Barbara Tuchman wrote about, and John Kennedy had in his mind, that things just start falling apart. Dominoes in a line keep knocking each other down until we had a war which killed millions of people. you say in your book, and you talk about the fact that this man, this religious man, did not particularly want to take the United States into war when it first, when all those dominoes started falling.
And no, he didn't. He didn't, and he didn't. Right down to John. Right down to practically the day that he went before Congress to ask for the declaration of war. In fact, he made a really heartfelt statement off the record to a leading newspaper editor about just how awful what it was going to do, how it was going to tear the country apart, how it was going to tear the world apart. And in many ways, the most eloquent argument against going into World War One came out of the mouth of the man who took us in.
The next day.
Or within a couple of weeks, yeah.
A couple of weeks of that, yeah. Now, he did get us into a war. We had not been involved in a war in Europe before, had we? Were we sent troops to Europe?
No. Our biggest overseas involvements, John, had been the Philippines, and then the relief of the Boxer in China for the Boxer Rebellion, and neither of those were really large scale military operations.
But we sent hundreds of thousands.
That's right, two million.
And yep. How many people did we lose? How many people were killed?
About 175,000. I'd have to look that up.
Which is twice, going on three times the number that we lost in Vietnam in terms of killed.
That's right.
We had people coming home who were gassed because they used poison gas, chlorine gas. The world was changed in terms of the tactics that were used. Guns turned into tanks, which turned into planes. It turned into the use of air power, naval power. All of this was concentrated, and we still had, on top of all that, we had the development of Russia as a going from a czarist country to a communist society.
Mm-hmm.
All of this rolled in together, and the major powers, they won. I mean, we won in a sense, right? The West, the Allied powers, Britain, France, the United States, and several others, Italy, I think, won against Germany. But the peace was another part of the problem had to face.
It's the peace that failed. It lasted 20 years, and it literally, World War II broke out in Europe almost exactly 20 years after the signing of the peace treaty in Versailles.
I hold back from asking my guests to prognosticate about the transition or the comparison between, say, 1914 to 1918 with today. However, there are parallels, are there not?
Sure, there are. Turmoil. I mean, just terrible turmoil in the world. And the Cold War, it's terrible to say this, but in some ways the Cold War was almost a blessing, because it was very clear. The adversaries and the adversaries, and in the sense of the playing field, was very clear. Now what we've got this turmoil, and we've got these failed states and all of that. That's much more the way the world looked during and at the end of World War One.
James Baker, who was a former Secretary of State under George H.W. Bush, made the statement at the end of the end of the Cold War. A few months later, he said, "We will look back on the Cold War as the good old days." And in that sense, there's a certain truth to that.
I'm afraid so.
Well, now, John, at the end of our show, I want to sort of focus on the last area, which struck me as a legacy or an area of controversy about Woodrow Wilson, and that is the Treaty of Versailles and the League of Nations and his stroke, his illness. Tell us, can you tie that together in the last bit of our conversation?
Well, the League of Nations was his idea, or not his alone, by the way. Wilson, one thing he did not like to think of himself as, and frankly did not like, period, were people who were in politics who were prophets with big ideas, because he believed, he was a good disciple of Edmund Burke in this sense, and said so, that ideas in politics needed to germinate and generate, and had to be discussed and worked around and had to gain a certain currency or saliency, but before they could really come to fruition. So that he was very careful. He wanted to do something to try to make World War I, something like World War I, impossible again. In other words, you use that phrase, create a new world order. But it had to be, he believed that you had to have something other than just nation states pursuing their own interests, that you had to have a mechanism to keep peace. And he was not the original. In fact, his great rival, Theodore Roosevelt, was the first major American to propose a league to keep peace, a league empowered to keep peace. But he had this idea. He did not know when he'd been very circumspect about pushing it too far until he went to the peace conference. And what he wanted to see was what it was like, what the possibilities might be. And he found that the situation was more promising than he thought. So he moved. He moved fast. He and basically two other people, Lord Robert Cecil of Britain and Jan Christian Smuts of South Africa, really put it together. And within the space of about a month, came up with the covenant, the draft covenant of the League of Nations. And then what he did was he embedded it into the peace treaty, and it was part of the peace treaty. And came back, and then his second great task was to try to sell it at home and to get it approved by the Senate. And that proved to be a tough sell, to put it mildly, because a lot of politicians had taken their stands already, and including the Republican chairman of the Foreign Relations Committee, Henry Cabot Lodge, were very critical. Some senators were outright diehard opponents, including, for example, Bob La Follette, were just absolutely opposed to it. So Wilson was trying to sell this, and he first tried retail, which was meeting with individual senators and trying to bring them around, and then he went wholesale, which was to take his case to the people, and he made this speaking tour to try to whip up public opinion. And it was about two-thirds of the way through that tour that he physically broke down. He couldn't go on, and so his doctor canceled the rest of the trip, rushed him back to the White House, and about 4 days after he got back, he suffered a severe stroke. And then he had, on top of that, a bladder infection after that that almost killed him. And he was never the same person after that. I mean, this is, John, this is the worst incident. If you can describe something that went on for 18 months as a crisis, it was the worst crisis of presidential disability we've ever had. And it was largely covered up. His wife later claimed that no, she never was surrogate president. She never did that. Well, she controlled access to him. And in many ways, we know that the person who controlled access to the president is the president. And we functioned largely without a president. But it's worse than that, too. What happened, the consequences of the stroke for Wilson, besides a good deal of paralysis on his left side, were that his judgment was warped. His emotional balance and his judgment was warped, and he then became the biggest obstacle of all to any kind of compromise with his critics and opponents that might have taken us in on a kind of limited liability membership in the League of Nations, which a half loaf, which we're still arguing that whether that half loaf would have been better than none, but still, and it's just he was a broken man. It's just he should have resigned. There should have been some mechanism for easing him out of office. There wasn't. And by the way, the 25th Amendment is not nearly as much protection for something like this, for presidential disability situations, as we think it is. I mean, the worst kind of thing is not the physical collapse of the president, but it's some kind of mental collapse or emotional collapse. That's still a problem we have, and a danger, really.
Well, we are unfortunately coming close to being out of time, but there's another aspect of his character which you've just touched on, which is a part of your book and is a part of the life of Woodrow Wilson. Mm-hmm. Here is a man who was greatly interested in, supportive of, and in love with women.
Yes.
And,
yes.
And the women that he was close to had a great effect on their lives, on his life, mm-hmm. and therefore the life of the country. In fact, he had a wife and children, and she died.
Mm-hmm.
And then he had met another woman and fell in love with her, and this was Edith, the famous
That's
Edith,
right.
And she was the surrogate president, as it were. But he also had another good friend who may or may not have been purely platonic, right?
That's right. That's Mary Peck, Mrs. Peck. Oh, yes. He met her. He had some what we think are probably pre-stroke symptoms back when he was president of Princeton, and had to take some time off and do vacations at a doctor's order. So he went to Bermuda, and a couple of times he went by himself, and that's where he met Mrs. Peck, who was a rather glamorous divorcee who was living, well, I wasn't divorced yet, but anyway, living apart from her husband in Bermuda, and he was smitten with her. You know, he just plain smitten, and then he started up a correspondence. You can get more insight into Wilson's thinking at certain times in his life from his correspondence with her than you can get from just about any other source. And how far that went, we don't know.
Okay.
He was, though, let's just put it this way. He was a man with a very strong sex drive.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, we know about those things.
Yep.
But
yes,
we've had that throughout our history. Okay. Just one sentence. What is the role or the place of Woodrow Wilson in the presidential history of the United States?
The man who presided over one of the three greatest reform programs in presidential history, the other two being the New Deal and the Great Society, and the man who successfully took us through our first major overseas war and tried to make us play a responsible, constructive, great power role in the world.
John Milton Cooper, you did it. Thank you very much.
That was a complex sentence, wasn't it, John?
That was a tough last sentence, but it's hard to bring it all together. John, thank you very much for being with us on With Respect. We appreciate it very much, and lots of luck. I love the book. It's a fascinating book and well written.
Thank you very much, John. This is a real pleasure.
We are on With Respect. This is John Smetanka. We'll be on next Sunday and Thursday. Remember, until next week, if you show respect to other people, they will show respect to you.